So I'd like to take you from the War of 1812 right up to the Civil War, get close to it at least, or at least up where we're knocking on the door of the Civil War. And in order to do that, we have to look at some of the changes that take place in the nation as it develops. And of course, you've been with us since the beginning. You understand there has been a situation between the rights of the states versus the rights of the federal government from the very get-go. Sometimes we're led to believe that, you know, that kind of just arose during the Civil War. That's not true. That battle really was never settled until the Civil War came about, and it was settled by force during the Civil War. But the disagreement between the rights of the states as opposed to federal government was a battle that waged from the days of Jefferson and Monroe right on through up until the time of the Civil War. And our country makes a lot of changes. For instance, as we come into the War of 1812 and Madison is in power, a name begins to shine, and that name was the name of Marshall, who was the Supreme Court Justice who became famous. He made as many decisions, I guess, as a lot of the justices that have followed him. But the one important thing that Marshall did was to establish the dominance of the federal government over the rights of the states. And when he came into power, he basically found the judiciary, which is one of the three departments of our government. Our government exists in the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. And the judiciary was one of the weakest branches of the government when Marshall came into his seat on the Supreme Court. When he left, it was the most powerful. And to this day, it remains the most powerful branch of the federal government. And the reason is because of Marshall's work greatly. And Marshall went about and set about to establish a protector of the American Constitution in the hands of the legislative branch, and that's basically what he did. Up until that time, Congress had been pretty much free to enact legislation, anything that they felt was necessary or needed. They enacted that legislation. It became the president's job to kind of carry out what Congress had implemented, whatever the law was. It was his job to enforce it. And basically, the legislative branch of government had the supreme power. And the only time that the judiciary was called upon was in matters of disagreement between the two branches of government, or in matters where the law simply and obviously was not a good law. Other than that, the judiciary kept its mouth shut. When Marshall came in, Marshall began to determine that laws were or were not constitutional. And that's where that phrase comes from. Marshall was the one who decided, I think, over 500 cases that he heard in his time on the bench and rendered decisions to, and a lot of them based on the fact that this law simply is not constitutional. Not that it's a good law or a bad law, not that it's unable to be enforced or able to be enforced, not that there's a disagreement between the executive and the legislative branch of the government, but simply on the fact that Marshall felt this law was a violation of the Constitution of the United States. And so the legislative began to be viewed as protectors of the Constitution. And basically, that's all we know of the legislative branch today, is that they're there to determine the constitutionality of a law when it is enacted, or basically to impeach or whatever, here the case of impeachment against the president or whatever might be necessary in that realm. But the federal government expands in its hold, or as it, in its power, as the judiciary expands, because basically they're there to be protected. The Congress now is limited in the laws that they can and cannot pass, and of course the judiciary is there to protect, in their own ideas, the Constitution of the United States. Now we come through the presidencies of Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. And in these elections, we've begun to see the difficulties arising from the Electoral College system. We're not finished with that system yet. There's still more difficulties. But following the War of 1812, some things took place rather rapidly in the United States. We talked about the important changes that the War of 1812 rendered in our benefit as America last week when we ended the session. We talked about the fact that really America was not thought of as any type of a power at all until the War of 1812. And although the war was totally unnecessary in that war was declared by the United States several days after England had already agreed to drop the things that really was ticking America off, so the war need not even have been fought, and the fact that the greatest battle we won, which was the Battle of New Orleans, took place a couple days after the treaty had been signed. So, you know, really nothing profitable as far as a war was concerned, kind of a scrungy type war. But that war gave America some clout, I guess is probably the best phrase. And as far as world economics and world politics is concerned, America was no longer looked on as some fledgling nation doing its best just to eke out a living. America now was seen as a nation that had some power, a nation that if tested could win a military battle, a nation that had its own economy and was basically what it said, independent of European nations. But because of that, some other colonies in this part of the world began to say, hey, we want what America's got. We want to have what they've got. And of course, America being the English settlement, but south of us in the South Americas came, there's a lot of countries down there that have been settled under Spanish colonization. And a lot of Spanish colonies begin to say, we want to be free from the colonization or the mother country as well. And Mexico broke ties with Spain. Mexico declared her independence. And then came, you remember, I'm trying to think of the guy's name that rode through Venezuela, and Bolivar, Simon Bolivar, that came through, and Colombia declared its independence, and Venezuela declared its independence. And then you've got Peru and Chile down there fighting battles for independence. And what happened was kind of a outgrowth of revolution when people saw that America had not only broke with England but now had established itself as a free and independent country during the War of 1812, a country that not only would say that it was free but had the ability to defend itself and to provide for itself now. That spark spread through the South American countries and they began to throw off their rulers as well. In Europe, remember, what had been going on in Europe? As is always, a war between England and France. And, the tyrant that was in charge of the French aspect of it was Napoleon Bonaparte. And Napoleon basically was not just ruling France, but he had conquered a great amount of Europe and had deposed a lot of kings and put them out of power. He was building his own little empire, and Napoleon is defeated. We talked about that last week. Right in the middle of the War of 1812, Napoleon is defeated, and as America basically is finishing out winning the War of 1812, Europe is beginning to readjust to life without Napoleon. And what happens there is some of these kings begin to return to their thrones, they begin to assume power again. France puts another king, so much for the French Revolution. France puts another king on the throne, and all of those countries begin to re-establish what we would have to call, I guess, normalcy. And as they do, they begin to organize themselves into a holy alliance. And the term holy should tell you something, that there is a religious outfit involved in all of it. Most of these kings are of the same religious persuasion. Remember, just a few years before that, we had talked about the rule in Europe. We had talked about the papal power in Europe and their sway over the kings, and how England basically became separated from Europe because not of its political viewpoint, but because of the fact that they refused to kowtow to the papacy in Rome. And now that Napoleon is gone, who also was, remember, that same religious outfit, and after he's gone, these kings begin to be reestablished. And the desire is to set up a system so that we don't have to worry about being driven off the throne anymore. Obviously, these kings want to protect their throne, and they've learned from their bad experience with Napoleon, and so they desire to put down an even stronger control than that they've had before. And they organize what's called a Holy Alliance, which is a bunch of Catholic kings agreeing to protect each other, basically. And they get together and decide that they're going to organize this Holy Alliance. And in the discussions, they also decide that we're going to go and take some of these colonies back that have been declaring their independence. They've taken advantage of us just because we were weakened by Napoleon. And we're going to go get these colonies and teach them a lesson. We'll go reconquer them. We'll give some of them back to Spain, and we'll hold others for ourselves. But we're going to stop this radical thought of liberty and independence. And that's basically the way they worded it, that liberty was a danger to the world. And so they were going to stop it. They were going to place everything back under a monarchical system. And as they were drawing up their plans, words, of course, gets to Washington. And we've talked about our presidents. You ought to be able to remember who the first five presidents of the United States are, especially if you're from Toledo. And there is no excuse, if you're from Toledo, not knowing who the first five presidents of the United States were. All the streets that run perpendicular to the river downtown are named after presidents. And the ones that run parallel are named after the Great Lakes, I guess. So you ought to know we've got Washington and Adams and Jefferson right on down the line. And we've got Madison. And then, of course, the big street is Monroe. And Monroe is the next president in line after Madison. And Monroe comes to power. And basically, Monroe is famous for what we call the Monroe Doctrine. Okay, now that's one of the most important, or one of the important pieces of legislation in the development of our country. Basically, America has violated it at will, and you know, the rest of the nations around the world have been held to upholding it while we don't uphold it ourselves. But Monroe saw what was coming. He heard the word from this alliance, this Holy Alliance in Europe. He saw what was coming, looming on the horizon. He knew that there was going to be another war if something was not done to nip it in the bud, so to speak, get it while it had it, before it had a chance to really formulate. And Monroe was pursuing an alliance with the King of England. And that alliance would have stood against the Holy Alliance of Europe. In other words, they wanted to put together some kind of an agreement that said, we're going to stop you. We are not going to allow you to come back into the Americas. We're not going to allow it. And Monroe had a Secretary of State. Losing lights out here. And Monroe's Secretary of State came to him and said to him, why do we have to go back to England? What basically are we going to profit from establishing again a tie with England? We don't need England. We just beat them in a war. They don't mean anything, and we don't need to go about and reestablish connections between ourselves and the English country. And so that fellow's name was John Quincy Adams. He was the son of the second president of the United States. And basically, Monroe took his advice. And Monroe launched out on his own independently as the president of an independent country and said to the Holy Alliance in what's now called the Monroe Doctrine, hands off the Americas. And what the Monroe Doctrine is basically is a statement to the European countries that they are to stay out of the Americas. They have no right, they have no claim here in this part of the world. They are not to come here and attempt to colonize. Basically, it was 3 points, and the first one was, number one, you stay out. Number two, you have no right to form any new colonies in this part of the world. And number three, which is the one we violate most frequently, is the United States agrees to stay out of European affairs. And, of course, you know, the hypocritical nation that we have become, and I say that with a grain of humility about it, you know, everybody else is expected to obey the rules, and we broke ours basically beginning World War I and have violated about 30, 40 times since then. And, of course, we used the Monroe Doctrine as early as the war down in Argentina, trying to keep Europe out of invading down there when the English went down there. We used it again in 61 and 60 when Kennedy went after the missile crisis down there in Cuba. We always cite the Monroe Doctrine when it is to our benefit, and when we decide to go into Europe, it's always under a treaty alliance, you know, NATO or something like that. We're here to help you guys out. But nonetheless, Monroe places the Monroe Doctrine and these kings that make up the Holy Alliance. Basically, I've got listed here France, Russia, Prussia, and Austria. That doesn't sound like too formidable a thing today, but of course, Russia under the Tsars, Prussia would be what we call Germany now, and Austria was the Österreich Republic under the Habsburgs, dominion. The Habsburgs, some of the richest kings that ever ruled in Europe. I mentioned several weeks ago seeing the Spear of Longimanus, which is in Vienna. And there's a museum there. I've been through there, and I guess Brad and Kit both were. They've got emeralds in there the size of my fist. on the end of goblets and golden scepters. They've got robes that these kings wore that were encrusted with diamonds and rubies, and the thread is gold thread, gold wire. You talk about some wealth. These people had some wealth. And that's the Habsburgs that ruled. When you see European cities, there's a what they call a Habsburg gold. When you look at the cities, some of the houses will be painted a quaint little gold color. It's not a bright gold, it's more of a tan color, but that's a Habsburg color. That signified that was one of the Habsburgs, one of the monarchies, either a summer house or a summer palace or something. They're all over the European countryside. And so you're dealing with a lot of power here and a lot of control. And these people sought to solidify their control in Europe and to, again, move back into the Americas as they had done prior to the Revolutionary War in an attempt to colonize and, of course, expand their borders. Germany, you kind of feel sorry for Germany after you study their history. Germany's kind of landlocked. And Germany has no place to grow, and every time Germany's tried to colonize, she gets in trouble. So same thing with Austria and these countries. I'm not trying to justify them. I'm just trying to say this is what they're thinking. You know, where are we going to expand our borders? Where are we going to have new cities? And they look over here, and here's these 13 colonies with a chunk of land the size of Asia. And they think, why not go over and get some of that for ourselves? And that was their idea. But the Monroe Doctrine put a stop to that. The idea was, you can't do it. We're not going to allow it to happen. And we will withstand you wherever you come. We're willing to fight and go to war because you're not going to come and do that. And again, not that there wasn't strength there, but the plan wasn't formulated enough for anybody to basically stand against the Monroe Doctrine. And it became a policy, and of course, really, in a lot of sense, protected the American interests here in this hemisphere. Now, following Monroe, and I'm just, again, I'm sliding through here as quickly as I can, following Monroe comes another election. And in this election, there is another problem with the Electoral College. Of course, after the War of 1812, the great hero of our nation was who? No, the other one. Battle of New Orleans, who was it? Brother Larry would know, Barb ought to know. Yeah, Jackson, Andrew Jackson. And it was Andy Jackson that had defeated the British down at the Battle of New Orleans. And we talked about the fact last week his ragtag regiment had set up there in New Orleans to defend it against British invasion. And when the British had attacked, Jackson held his men. They didn't allow them to fire, so they were right up on them. And in 30 minutes, Jackson's regiment killed 2,100 British soldiers out of an army of about 5,000. He basically took out about half of them in 30 minutes. And the battle was over. But he became the first real American, you know, dyed-in-the-wool hero. He was a commoner. He wasn't like Washington and Jefferson, who were the aristocratic, caste. This guy was Tennessee hillbilly, you know, cut out of the same thing that all the other common folks were. And he had won a victory. So he became a great hero at this time in our nation's development. So much so, they wanted him to be the president. And so he was put on the ballot with several other men and ran for president against Adams. And when the election was held, according to the rules of the Electoral College, Jackson had more votes than anybody. But the rules of the college were that unless someone established a clear-cut majority, he could not be elected. Now, that's been changed. Your last president was just elected without a majority of people's votes. But under the old system, without a majority of the vote, you could not be elected president. So while Jackson had more votes cast for him from the Electoral College than anybody else, there was not a majority of the vote behind him. And so the vote had to be decided by the House of Representatives of the United States, and they elected John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson. Now you see the problems that are coming. We've had problems here where, one man had the other opposing man that ran against him as his vice president because of the Electoral College. Then you had another situation where a man and his vice president were both elected and tied, and they had to have 36 ballots to decide which one got to be president, even though only one of them had been running for president. And now you got a situation where the man elected president didn't get it. And that can still happen under the system that the Electoral College is a very weak system, and it's kind of, we hold on to it because of tradition, I guess, or whatever the reason might be, nobody really knows. But some things have been changed and weeded out to make it stronger, but it still has its problems. John Quincy Adams comes to the presidency. And he was the Secretary of State, as we mentioned, under Monroe. He was also the son of John Adams. He was a very intelligent young man. He was, at this time, he's an old man, but even as a young man, he'd been involved in American politics and was a statesman, a very strong Federalist. And again, the war that wages between the Federalists and the Republicans, or the Anti-Federalists, still is great in our country, and it really is not going to come to a head until the War of 1865. But as he comes into power, the first thing that he does is he begins to initiate new tariffs. Tariffs were there to protect, supposedly, American interests by prohibiting importation of goods from overseas that would damage American industry here in this country. And you and I would understand that better in the Japanese invasion, with a foreign car market. And any of you fellows that have worked in the auto industry, you've kind of got a smug appearance and a nasty word for anybody that owns a Japanese car or a foreign import because, that hurts American jobs. Well, that's why tariffs came into being. And tariffs were designed so that they couldn't send something over here and sell it cheaper than what we could produce it for. If they could, in other words, if they could, we'd buy, let's say we could produce thimbles here for ladies to sew with, and we produce thimbles for, 25 cents a piece, but in Europe they can manufacture them for 4 cents a piece because they've got the industry. And by the time they ship them over here to this country, they can bring them into this country for 10 cents a piece. Who's going to buy an American thimble? So tariffs were instituted to take those 10-cent thimbles and add a 15-cent tariff to them so that their prices, when they got into America, was the same price as an American good. And therefore, Americans could compete, although that's not the meaning of free enterprise at all. That's basically the way we worked it. And Adams brings in what's called by most people the Tariff of Abominations. The Tariff of Abominations was such a widespread tariff program that basically nothing could get into the country without the government, getting a hand on it and getting some cash out of it. And what you're finding at this point is, I guess I'll go ahead and bring it out at this point. Not only is there a division between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, what do the Federalists believe? Strong federal government. What do the Anti-Federalists believe? States' rights. Not only is there a real, at odds division between those people, but there is also a separation of America. America is naturally and geographically polarizing. And as we come through this period of development here, you've got three regions, basically, that you have to consider. If you don't, really, it's a strange thing. The Civil War becomes nothing more than a war of slavery. And I'm not trying to make it out unimportant to talk about slavery. We certainly will. But really, slavery. Matter of fact, Abraham Lincoln did not free or did not grant liberty to the slaves till the war was basically over anyway. It was not a war fought over slavery. You get this idea that he declared freedom for the slaves and the South said no and the North said yes and they went to war. Wasn't it at all. The North never granted freedom to the slaves till the war was almost over. And the war was much more broad spread than that. And you'll see it if you begin to keep an eye on the difference between the Federalists and the non-Federalists or the anti-Federalists, and as you begin to see the nation polarize. Of course, the first colonies were established where? Massachusetts, Maryland, Virginia, up into there, what we would call basically the northeast part of our country, and still is to this day a separate geographical entity. We consider the northeast as a different part of our country. Certainly a part of America was just different up there. Those people talk funny up there. You know, they say car, endure, and all that kind of stuff, and car doer, and all that kind of thing. But if I don't lose my voice here, the northern part of our country, northeast, is developing basically 100 years ahead of the rest of the nation. See, they had a 100-year head start, and their cities are 100 years older than some of these other cities. And then you've got the south, or the southern part of our country. And the southern part of our country, obviously, developing much slower than the northern part. And climates are different. And because climates are different, they major on different industries or different ways of making a living in those two parts of the country. And they begin to polarize. Their interests are not the same. You understand what I'm saying? So the southern states' interests are not the same as the northern states, and there begins to be a polarization. Not only that, it wasn't just north and south, but there was a third region of our country, and it was called the West. And of course, following the War of 1812, I mentioned to you that it really opened America up for westward expansion. The Indians basically were, as far as the threat, they were pushed back across the Mississippi. And all of that land now is open for expansion. Can you imagine for a moment that basically the large settlements ended in Pittsburgh prior to 1812? If you drew a line from Pittsburgh south, there are some cities, certainly. There are even some states west of that, but not a lot of settlement. And now that's all wide open, and people begin to push in that direction. Well, there's not any industry there. You see, the way of life there is completely different than it is in the North or the South. There is a totally different attitude or outlook on what life is all about among those people. So basically, you've got a threefold separation. Thank you, brother. Ask and it shall be given. Well, that's good. You've got a threefold separation in the United States. Now, that's not a national thing. It's not an ethnic thing. I mean, it's not just, you know, the Jews went north and the blacks went south and somebody else. It wasn't an ethnic thing. The division was marked on living. Everybody in America at this time is just about living, staying alive, preserving their liberty, raising their families. But in the North and the South, there began to be two different philosophies about how to do that. The people that lived in New Hampshire, what did they want to do? They wanted to make a living. They wanted to raise their families. They wanted to worship the way they wanted to worship. What did the people in the South want? The same thing. So while their desires were the same, what did the people in the West want? What did the people in the Ohio Territory want? The same thing. While their goals were the same, the philosophies began to be different because of the difference in development in this country. The North, as I said, 100 years ahead of everybody. Now, that may be hard to realize, until you go to some of these Eastern Bloc countries. If you ever have an opportunity to go visit or even see pictures of some of these Eastern Bloc countries after the Iron Curtain fell, you'll see some nations that basically have just been shut up for 70 years. And in 70 years, it is amazing how far behind they are. As a matter of fact, all of Europe basically is probably 20 to 25 years behind America. Everywhere I've ever been over there, you kind of get the idea that you've been thrown back to the 60s. And, they've got nice things, but you stay in a $100 a night hotel in Switzerland and you don't have a TV in your room. I mean, they got a little room downstairs with one TV up on the wall. And if you want to go down there and sit and watch TV, you can. You know, that's a $100 a night hotel. They're just not as developed. In Albania, the children, I've got pictures of 9, 10, and 11-year-old children that were hauling gravel to repair the railroad in 1979. Little kids pushing wheelbarrows to repair the railroads. That's 100 years behind. I mean, those people are way behind. And so it's hard to imagine how much development has taken place, but just think for a moment, if you took 100 years off of today and launched yourself back to 1890, what all you're doing without? You not only will eliminate space travel, you're back to riding on a horse. Automobiles, what, 1913, 1919, somewhere into there? I mean, Henry Ford's not around yet. You're back to riding to town on a buckboard wagon. Mass production factories aren't even in existence yet. Ford brought those in. You're still back to going to see the blacksmith when you needed something iron or something metal prepared or made, or the silversmith. I mean, you take 100 years away from our country and figure that at this period in time, the northern cities, the northern states are basically 50 to 100 years ahead of the South. And the South is 40, 50 years ahead of the West. And so you begin to get polarization. We'll talk about that a little more in just a minute. But you need to remember that as you watch our nation develop. Because that development basically makes or creates the rift that we know as the Revolutionary War, the War of 1865. So Jackson is elected, but he's not. Now, you know, that tend to tick some people off. If Jackson got more of the vote than anybody else in America, and then all at once he's not elected president. Why? Because your powerful states are those northern states where the Congress is, and now the House of Representatives is going to decide who the president is. They've got more clout, they've got more sway, and Andrew Jackson is an outsider. He's a southern boy. So Jackson's put on the sideline. And John Quincy Adams, and again, not to say anything bad about John Quincy Adams, but he was not the choice of the people. Well, at the close of Adams' term, there's another election. Guess who wins? Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson wins big time this time. Basically, in rebellion for what the House of Representatives had done. And Jackson is elected president, and for the first time, really, a grassroots, common American is elected president. And if you study the history, it's one of the peak times of patriotism and nationalism in our country's history. It is almost as though America had achieved a great war victory when no war had been fought. And it's kind of sad they had won a victory against their own government. And they had put the candidate in that they wanted. Jackson immediately becomes a very unpopular president. And actually ends up being one of the most unpopular of all. Up to that point, or here too, in history, the president, basically, he is the what branch of government? Executive. And what's the executive branch of government's job? It is to what the law? Enforce it. His job to enforce it. In other words, if Congress says everybody must wear blue shirts, it's the president's job to call the Army or the Navy or the Marines or whoever and say, you don't have on a blue shirt, you're going to jail. It's his job. Jackson changes all that a little bit. Basically because he's got a chip on his shoulder. I mean, he'd been elected and didn't get the office. And I can just let you imagine what kind of an attitude he had toward Congress, particularly the House of Representatives. And when he comes into office, he represents himself not as a man of Congress, but as a man of the people. And Jackson begins to talk about the American people. He says, you know, the American people gave me my job, and I'll serve the American people and, you know, hang the Congress. That's what his attitude was. And because of that, he makes some drastic changes in the way government is done and instills some problems and basically splits some political parties, and America is going to become a little more like what you and I know America politically is all about because of Jackson. And when he comes into power, his vice president is Calhoun, who is a senator from the state of South Carolina and plays a key role in the war between the states eventually because of his arguments for states' rights. Let me digress just a minute and show you how this Federalist, anti-Federalist thing is still alive. As late as near the end of the War of 1812, I think it was around 1814, 1815, there was a group of states that met in what was called the Hartford Convention. And the Hartford Convention basically met and stated that they held to the states' rights to disannul any law or any treaty made by the federal government. In other words, if the federal government passed a law the states didn't write, it was their viewpoint, didn't like, it was their viewpoint, the states could say, hey, fine, we don't want it. We disagree with it. It's not the law in this state. That's as late as the War of 1812, and that's the northern states now that are doing that. And the idea is the North is beginning to develop its own interests that are different from those of the South or those of the West, and now everybody wants to protect their interests, and the best way to do that, when you got people trying to protect their interests, they always become anti-federal government. They have to. And so the North now is making statements. Marshall is the guy who kind of nips that in the bud by really expanding federal power, but he doesn't get rid of the sentiment. All right. In other words, he can let the wind out of the sails of the Hartford Convention by saying you can't do that. Whatever law the federal government passes is federal law. But that doesn't change the sentiment in the hearts of the people. And what it does is it further isolates the people from their government. And that's what's happening in this day and time is you're seeing an isolation of the government from its own people. And you can make all the laws you want to. Well, Jackson's idea was, matter of fact, he even cited against Marshall, I believe, on one of his decisions, and Marshall came back and said that law is not constitutional, therefore it's not a good law, and Jackson said, let's see him try to enforce that. I mean, he just stood right up against the Supreme Court justice and said, I don't give a rip what you think. You know, you don't have any power, I've got the power, and I'll enforce what I want to enforce. And you say, well, you know, that's terrible. No, it's kind of good for government. It's good for government to be preoccupied with itself. Things like Watergate and Whitewater, all that stuff has a wonderful influence on government. The House banking scandal, that stuff is excellent because it keeps them from bothering us. Okay, it gets them preoccupied with themselves, and they don't have time to sit down and figure out what else they can do to mess things up. And so Jackson now is at odds with the Congress big time. He's at odds with the judiciary big time. But the American people like him. The American people, see, they've been asserting their independence for years. The Hartford Convention and the states' rights movement, the anti-federalists, all these people have been asserting themselves, but nobody's had the guts to stand up. And Jackson now is doing it. But the sad thing about it is that, strangely enough, when people like that become opposed to big government, they do more to progress the cause of big government than to bring it down. Thomas Jefferson did more to encourage big federal government in this country than probably anybody that preceded him, although he was probably the most outspoken against big government. And so, you know, the idea of history is you better not trust the Republicans you just elected to get government off your back. It ain't gonna happen. Matter of fact, the Republicans have always been those that have been known as anti-federal government, and they've done more to instill strong federal government than the Democrats have with both hands tied behind their back. What a thought. Now, what is that? That's just the rules of history. That's the lessons of history. And what begins to take place now is that while Jackson is opposed to a large federal government, he begins to put in some of the policies that have led us to where we are today. First of all is the idea that to the victor belong the spoils. And that idea is, since I've been elected now, I have, you hear the word mandate. How many times do you hear the word mandate? Every time somebody gets elected now, it's a mandate. You know, and everything, listen, if you watch television, I'd just encourage you, just take a notepad, and from the time you watch the television, write down how many times you hear one phrase. I challenge you. I want to show you how you're being programmed. The phrase is, change is good. I'll guarantee you, you're hearing that 25 times a night, and you don't even know it. It's on everything from Burger King to Taco Bell to everything you're listening to. You'll hear, I don't even remember where it was tonight, somewhere on a news broadcast. Change is good. Change is not always good, folks. And when you're hearing something repeated again and again and again and again, that's called propaganda. It was used in the German Empire back when Hitler established, and that's what's happening in America right now. Change is good. You say, well, they're talking about getting change back, you know, when you give them a dollar at the drive-thru. Are they? Change is good. Then why is it you hearing it 15, 20, 25 times a day? Somebody's trying to convince you that whoever goes wherever and tries to change things is your best friend. And sometimes you better off leave things alone. Amen? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You got a lot of people trying to fix things that ain't broke. Under the idea that change is good. Well, Jackson begins to fix something. He says, I'm here on a mandate. The people of America have elected me and they rebelled. You tried not to put me in the last time, but they've got me in here now. And so basically what I'm going to do is all you guys that work for the federal government, you're fired. I'm going to hire my own people. And he begins to fire. He dismisses, I think at one time, as many as one-fifth of all the people that worked in the various jobs there in Washington. And starts putting his friends and people in. That's where the idea to the victor belongs, the spoils come from. That's why you have a transition team goes to Washington every time you get a new political party elected. And all the justices are fired, or the attorneys are fired, and all these guys are fired. You get a new cabinet, and a new this, and a new that. Now you've got it on, you know, well, that's the way things are done. Well, you thank Mr. Jackson for that. The guy who stood strong against federal government, you know where the biggest expenditure you have now in tax money goes, or one of the biggest ones, is in taking care of all them jerks that go up there to help that guy out. I think it was the vice president of Franklin Roosevelt, I can't remember exactly, I've been reading this week too much, I guess, but I'll get to it when we get there. As late as Roosevelt or up in through there, World War I, World War II era, when the vice president went to Washington, he paid to rent his own place. And paid his own staff out of his salary. And now you've got up there, you've got a vice president's wife that has a staff bigger than most presidents had up till about 15 years ago. The vice president's wife spends several millions of dollars every year just to keep her entourage together. What is that? Well, I got elected, you know, and this guy's been my next-door neighbor for years, and our kids play together, and they're friends, and, you know, they need a job, and we ought to give them this job, and so there you go. To the victor belongs the spoils. Thank you, President Jackson. Did a wonderful job there. Also during this period of time were some great states' rights debates. Notice under each president, the issue has come up again and again and again. Who has the rights? The rights, of course, of the argument under this regime or this president's time in office were called the Webster-Haynes debates. They're very famous debates. Haynes, of course, defended the fact that America was states and the power rested in the hands of the states. The states had the power to dissolve or whatever. And Webster, the fellow wrote the Encyclopedia, the dictionary that you use a lot, Webster's dictionary, he was the one that maintained that, and he made a decent statement, but his statement was kind of a little off the wall, at least as far as we look at it now. And the idea was, when he argued, he said, the power of America does not rest in the hands of the states, but in the hands of the people. And the Constitution is the document of the people. And the Constitution establishes a federal government, therefore, the federal government is the will of the people. That's, I mean, it's reasonable logic. But what happens, you know, if you get in trouble with your federal government? You don't leave a way out in that sense. But the debate waxed backwards and forwards, and it got so strong at one time, Jackson becomes a very strong Federalist. And that's amazing to watch that happen. You take an anti-Federalist and put him in government and watch him turn into a Federalist. Okay? And that's what's going to happen to this bunch of freshman congressmen who just went up there. You know, they went up there with great ideas, but the system's going to suck them up. You just watch it, you'll see it happen. And Jackson becomes a very strong advocate of federal government. Calhoun never does. Calhoun is a states' rights man all the way. Now remember, that's president and vice president. And he got so strong and bitter that one night at a reception at the White House, the president stood up and made a toast, you know, clinking the little glasses and all that kind of stuff. And he looked at his said, looked Calhoun square in the eye and lifted his glass and toasted the government of the people, the unity of the people. And made his toast to the strength of the government. Calhoun stood right up behind him, made another toast, and he said, yes, and he said, the government will last as long as it remembers where its power comes from. You know, I mean, you talk about a sharp criticism, the president and the vice president going after each other in a reception. So the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists are still at it. That's the point that I'm trying to make. We get this idea that, no, this is just something that happened in the War of 1865, and now again it's happened in the last few years, you know, people trying to downsize government, want to take back their government. That's always, from day one, it has been the plague of this nation, is who's going to run the show. It's always a question of power and authority. I mean, it is all the way back to the book of Isaiah and Ezekiel, where Lucifer said, I'll ascend the sides of the north. It's all about who runs the show. And you've got people that they're not concerned about people or ecology or environment. I mean, a lot of the smoke screens today are smoke screens for gaining power. People want power. And the roots of it are even back as far as this. During this period of time, there begins to be a division even among the Republicans. Now, remember at one time it was the Federalist Party, and then the Jefferson founded the Democratic Republicans, and really the Federalist Party ceased to exist because the Republicans or the Democratic Republicans have so dominated politics, and they basically adapted the ideas of the Federalists anyway. And when Jackson gets in power, though, there begins to be a little division. Matter of fact, he was referred to as King Andrew for a while, because he really didn't care what anybody said. If he felt like it was good for the country, he'd step out on it and take care of it. He vetoed more legislation than all the other presidents before him. Before him, the legislation that came to the president would be vetoed if, number one, they felt it was unconstitutional or something along that line. Jackson just vetoed if he didn't think it was good for the country. Something that the other presidents really didn't even think about. So Jackson was a patriot, and he was trying to balance this intricate thing of North and South and West. And again, I say he was a Federalist, but not a Federalist in the sense of big government, I don't think, but at least in trying to hold the Union together. It's the same thing Lincoln. I think Lincoln becomes basically a pawn in a game, and he's trying to hold a nation together. Sometimes we make Lincoln out to be a little more ugly than he is. Sometimes we make him too great. I think basically he and Jackson alike were just common men trying to do the best they could under some real extreme adverse conditions. Jackson's trying to hold the nation together. And he basically leads or encourages a split that occurs in the political parties. And the Republicans divide, and then all at once you've got a group of them calling themselves National Republicans. And rather than Democratic Republicans. And along about 1830, the Democratic Republicans drop the last part of their name and become known as just Democrats. And that basically is the Democratic Party that you have today. It was formed about 1830. And of course, the Republicans is the GOP, the Grand Old Party, because they go back supposedly a little bit further. But the Democrats basically come into existence around 1830. And the opposition again to Jackson grows to such an extent that the parties divide again, and you have a group known as the Whigs. How many of you ever heard of the Whig Party? The Whigs coming into existence. That's W-H-I-G. And the term is a British term, because the British individuals in Parliament, you know, they wear the little wigs and all that kind of stuff while they're in there. Look kind of stupid, but they still do all that. But the Whigs in England had been formed in opposition to a tyrannical king. To give you an idea, you know, we're dealing here with a president who thinks he's a king, or at least in their eyes he did. And so they form a party called the Whig Party in opposition to King Jackson over here. And the Whig Party comes into existence. Now, very quickly, let me skip ahead. You kind of got the proceedings. Following on the heels of Jackson comes Van Buren, Martin Van Buren. And basically, that's enough said about his presidency. He's kind of like one of them Gerald Ford characters that, you know, you say, was he president? Van Buren was the president. Doesn't do a whole lot. Following Van Buren, another war hero is elected. And his name is Harrison. All right. He had the right answer a while ago, just the wrong time. Harrison is elected. William Henry Harrison, who had been the great fighter in the War of 1812, had led the army for the American cause and had won some great victories up in the Canadian area. He runs on the ticket with a man by the name of Tyler, Harrison and Tyler. And that's where the running phrase, you know, Tippecanoe and Tyler too. I guess was the first tongue twist, first political slogan probably ever developed. A lot of rhetoric and didn't say much. Tippecanoe had been the battle where Harrison had defeated the Indians over in the Illinois area. And he'd become known as Tippecanoe because of his great victory there. And so the presidential campaign was Tippecanoe, Tyler too. He's elected. And America again, you know, America always historically feels more patriotic and feels stronger when it has a military hero as president. Go all the way around if you want to, but if you look at history, that's the way war heroes always have a better time, better chance of getting elected. This thing in the 60s when John Kennedy ran for president of the United States, John Kennedy proposed a real threat to the American way of life in that he was the first Roman Catholic to run for president, or at least to have a serious contention for it. And the press made a lot out of that. I mean, they used that against him, and he counterattacked with the fact that he was a great war hero, you know, PT-109 and all that, which really, to be honest with you, wasn't that great a deal. Kennedy was not nearly as great a hero as they made him out to be. But they, you know, they used that to counterattack, knowing full well that America respects a military man. And it's an interesting thought. But Harrison gets elected, America breathes a sigh of relief, and 30 days later, Harrison dies. And Tyler is placed in authority as President of the United States. So the term of William Henry Harrison is kind of short-lived and doesn't last very long. And now Van Buren is gone, Harrison is gone, and Tyler is in power. I'm going to leave off there this morning, but take just a moment to look at these different countries or different ideals that are developing in our country. Basically, you've got three countries. You want to remember that as we go. Two points you need to remember. I know I keep hammering them. But if you're going to understand history, you have to understand the difference between federal government and states' rights, and you have to understand the different regions of America and the way they think. We talk about this being a great melting pot, you know, and where, you know, everybody's together, and boy, it's an integrated society. Not on your life, man. Not in your wildest dreams. And the government has basically used that to their advantage. The government has become the great big grandmother that's going to take care of all of her grandchildren. And she's doing it in some real extreme ways. Okay? I'll give you the difference in ideals even in modern day America. Several months ago out in California, the fellow grabbed a can of spray paint and was painting graffiti all over the walls there in California. And a guy drove his car up, got out of the car, and shot him to death. Shot him right in the back. You say, well, he's not painting any graffiti anymore. Chicago just enacted legislation that made it illegal for you to buy spray paint inside the city of Chicago. You say, what is that? That's two different ideals. Two different ideals. To say that America is a fully integrated society, you're nuts. I'll tell you something else. Toledo is not even a fully integrated society. You've got different viewpoints everywhere you go, and the idea of the federal government is, well, we all think alike and we all want the same thing, so let us take care of you. That's not true. You don't have a clue what people want. I don't have a clue what people want. I know what I want, but what I want may not be what you want. And the idea that somebody's going to represent us both when they don't even know, we don't even know what we want all the time. You get this polarization. Let me give you some ideas. Physical conditions. In the North doesn't have any farms. Very small, poor farms when you find them. Not large agrarian society. A lot of small farms, you know, 5 or 10 acres, kind of like we'd see today. Guy buy 5 or 10 acres and plant him a crop, think he's got a farm or a ranch. and you know, basically doesn't have anything. Very good harbors in the north. We already know that. A lot of good harbor areas, a lot of good dock and storage area there in the north because of the rivers. You find an abundance of wood. They're manufacturing and producing coal and iron. There is a cooler climate, which is more conducive to a strong industry. You know, everybody says, well, you know, we don't like the snow up there. Yeah, but look where the industry is. Say what you want to, you know, everything's moving south. You look where the industry's at right now. And the industry is where there's a cool climate. You say, well, it's all moving south. It won't stay south. I've lived in the south. It won't stay south. You're going to lose production big time when you get. You say, why? Just the difference in climate will produce it. You get down into Mexico and it's, you know, mañana. We'll do it tomorrow. You say, well, that's because those people are lazy people. I'm going to tell you what, I've never seen as hard working people in my life as Mexicans. I say that to their credit. They'll outwork you and I any day of the week. You say, why are they that way in Mexico? Because it's hot. It is hot. And the further south you go, the warmer your climate gets, the less conducive it is to good work. And the north had that advantage, got a cool climate. The north had a lot of water power. Got a lot of forceful rivers up here. You look at Niagara Falls and some of those areas. And that power, that water can be harnessed to produce power. So the north physically has got some real strong advantages. You take the south, for instance. The south, what we got what we call, what is it, the song, Up the Lazy River? Most southern rivers, you know, it's kind of, they're not going anywhere. They're not in a hurry. Not a lot of strong water. A lot of large farms in the south. It was not unusual down there to have 400 and 500 acre plantations. Can you imagine 400 and 500 acres that one family was owning? A warmer climate, very few harbors. Think about the number of harbors in the northeast as opposed to the southeast. Not a lot of good harbors and waterfrontage. A lot of sand and shallow water down along the southeastern coast. So not a lot of good harbors to ship your goods out of. The crops became cotton and tobacco, basically. They exported a little bit of pine. Very few roads in the south as opposed to the north. Not many roads at all. And then to the west. Out in the west, you've got even larger farms. Wasn't unusual to have 2,000 or 3,000 acre farms in the Midwest. Simon Kenton, when he came into this country, basically at one time laid claim from all of the land from Springfield, Ohio, down almost to Lexington, Kentucky. That was his claim. And basically he ended up, they restricted him later on until he owned one county in Kentucky. Kenton County, right if you cross the river there, was Simon Kenton's claim. You know, they took some of his land away from him. Daniel Boone laid claim on, I don't know how many thousands of acres of land. Huge, huge farms. Not a lot of great crop growing out here, though, at first. They grew some corn, they grew some wheat. There's a moderate climate here, absolutely no harbors, and no roads. They raised a lot of cattle, a lot of pork, and a lot of beef. But you see how the differences are beginning to develop? We'll talk about them more next week, because that leads to a difference in a way of life.